This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Brazil has the largest concentration of people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere, but it's a country that slaughters young Black people by the tens of thousands every year. We'll hear from a member of the Black Brazilian Movement, and we'll speak with a writer who's researched the assassination of Black Brazilian politician Marielle Franco.
But first, the death of Black people at the hands of police is a constant flashpoint of U.S. politics. But increasingly, private security guards use lethal force against unarmed Blacks. In Philadelphia, Diop Olukbala of the Black Is Back Coalition says private security guards have been empowered to kill with impunity.
On March 12th, brother named Willie Oliver Wise, a 34-year-old African man, was shot and killed by an armed security guard at a cell phone store known as My Philly Wireless. Willie was a worker there. He did miscellaneous jobs for them, and the last job that he did, he was owed $10. And when he went to collect, the store management refused to pay him, which led to a verbal dispute, and Willie initially left, came back, the dispute continued, and at this point it starts to escalate where the security guard begins to make threats on his life, saying, "I'm going to kill you." And the next time Willie came back, that's what he did. The security guard shot him in the chest, killing him instantly. This is all over the fact that My Philly Wireless refused to pay him $10. Since then, the family immediately began to hold protests in front of My Philly Wireless on a daily basis. It's important to note that the DA and the police have not intervened in this struggle at all in terms of prosecution or even any known investigation on the events that led to Willie's death. But the community is clear, and Willie's family is clear, that not only was excessive force used in this situation, but Willie's killing was premeditated, as evident by the statement made by the guard that "I'm going to kill you."
So tell us about what Willie's family and the community have been doing and how you and the Black Is Back Coalition got involved.
Yes, so the family held a spontaneous protest in front of the store on the day he was killed and committed to do so every day since his killing, and have done so. We were, as Black Is Back Coalition and the Black Community Controller Police Working Group, we were invited by a friendly organization that was working with the Willie's family. On the fourth day, we were invited to come and participate in the march and protest, which we did. And we've been standing by the family's side ever since. We've attempted to provide organizational and tactical support, sound system, and develop flyers, and, you know, to help to get the demands around this struggle out into the general public in the community. And those demands include, of course, justice for Willie, meaning the criminal prosecution of the security guard and the store management and ownership, reparations to the family and Black community control of the police, and the immediate closure of My Philly Wireless. So these are the principal demands that we've been putting out during these daily protests, where masses of people pass through the sidewalk where we are stationed in front of the cell phone store. And we actually are planning on May 31st, a march on My Philly Wireless, which will begin at a nearby intersection, go through the neighborhood that Willie's from, and end up in front of the cell phone store, where various organizations and community members will speak out on the need to boycott My Philly Wireless and to build a movement to achieve the demands of the Willie Wise campaign, as well as the overall issue of the military occupation of our community, whereas we have numerous types of armed forces in our community, all of which are foreign and hostile. And the main problem, of course, is the Philadelphia Police Department. So at this rally, we plan to initiate a community-based struggle against the various ways in which police affect the lives of Black people and deny us justice, including in the case of Willie Wise's murder.
Now, in the course of supporting Willie Wise's family, you then came into conflict with these same security guards that killed Willie Wise.
That's correct, yes. We've been, as I stated, participating in the protest since March 15th. And during the time that we have been involved, we have experienced serious hostility and aggression at the hands of the security forces that work for My Philly Wireless. Prior to my arrest, which I will talk about, the security guards would spit on the ground right in front of the children and women and just be really rude and nasty with an obvious intent to bust up the protests that are targeting their bosses. And it got to the point where on a particular day, I was setting up for the demonstration, and one of the security forces, along with a few other men with him, began to verbally harass me as I was setting up our banner and sound system. And I got into a verbal altercation with one in particular who was, you know, calling me derogatory names and whatnot. And I hurled some insults back at him, but was clear that he's an enemy of the Black community, and they clearly targeted me and coming at me as a way to undermine and try to stop the people's movement. But that verbal altercation led to physical altercation, where one of the security forces approached me in response to me saying these things about him and criticizing him like this. He runs up in my face and says, "Call me this again, you know, say something again." And then he hauls off and hits me with a right hook. And then he steps back like he's ready to fight. And then he walks away. So that is the first thing. And a couple of days later, after one of our protests, and as we are set breaking down the equipment and everything, this same person yells at me in the middle of the road as I'm entering my vehicle that when I see you tomorrow, it's on site, meaning that it's going to be another altercation. So not knowing what he has in mind and knowing the history of the security forces that work under My Philly Wireless in terms of lethal force that they have been known to use, I came to the next protest with a pistol. And not with the intent for there to be an altercation. It was my hope that we would be able to successfully hold our protest without any such incident, but at the same time, understanding that anything can happen and therefore should be prepared. And as I arrive on the next day, the same force begins to verbally harass me. Two buildings down or the next building over, and he's talking his stuff, and I'm focused on the protest that we have planned, trying not to get drawn into anything. I flash my pistol so as to say, back off, I'm not for it. And about 7 or 8 minutes later, the police showed up and they begin to search me. At the time the police show up, I'm standing there next to our banner, essentially minding my business to anybody, you know, looking from outside. But the police approach me and demand a search, ask me if I'm carrying a weapon, and then begin to search me, at which time they take my weapon. I was taken into the nearby district and then, of course, booked and placed in the county jail on State Road, where I was held for 3 weeks Initially, I was held at a $100,000 bond. And then at my preliminary hearing, the bond was reduced to $25,000, which the Black is Back Coalition and other organizations quickly raised for my release. It's important to say that my hearing was attended, well attended. The courtroom was full with supporters, and I'm out in the streets now. We've continued, the family, even as I was locked up, the family continued to hold the protests. I'm, of course, organizing with them, and other comrades of the Black is Back Coalition are organizing alongside with the family in preparation for this march and to achieve the demands that I spoke of earlier. It's important to note that my arrest came as a consequence of an illegal search where I was showing no probable cause or reasonable suspicion to be searched at all. And we expect for this case to be thrown out based on this violation of justice and law.
Now, of course, the Black is Back Coalition and other groups in Philadelphia have long been fighting against police impunity. But again, they proliferate in cities around the country. Thousands of folks that many of us call rent-a-cops, some of whom believe they have the same impunities as the police.
Absolutely. What we're looking at is the state. Although these forces aren't uniformed cops, and some of them may very well be, a lot of these armed security forces throughout the country are cops, police, that work as security guards when they're not working officially on the clock as police. It's like a side hustle. And these forces have a license not only to carry arms, but to use lethal force in the interest of these parasitic merchants that set up shop in the oppressed and exploited Black community, these forces that extract thousands, tens of thousands of dollars every day from ghettos, from, you know, seriously impoverished communities like the one that My Philly Wireless is in North Philly. These people make a lot of money, and they need to have this armed force that is essentially an extension of the police or the colonial state itself to protect their economic interests. And the case of Willie Wise really exposes the political and economic dynamics. And when we talk about the relationship that the state and the police had to the Black community, where we have this exploited Black worker who is demanding $10, which is nothing, to a force like My Philly Wireless. They got locations all over the city, all over the area, actually. $10 is nothing, but their primary motive is profit, and they make that profit on the backs of Black people, and out of that relationship grows a certain kind of disrespect and disdain for Black people and disregard for Black life, and, you know, same thing as the police. And what we're seeing, really, the economic and political nature of the state, and although, again, these forces aren't necessarily functioning as the police, the fact that the police and the DA haven't done anything about Willie's murder is a statement as to the relationship that these security forces and their bosses have with the police department, the DA, and the state as a whole. They're all the same thing. And when we talk about Black community control of the police, we are not only talking about the need for the Black community to have the ability to have its own independent Black Community Control of Police Commission with power to hire, fire, train, and prosecute officially police officers, but we also talking about the ability to control the gun as a whole in the Black community, including these armed security forces that occupy our community in the name of profit generated by their bosses in these parasitic stores like My Philly Wireless. So the struggle for Black community control of police is a struggle ultimately to control the gun, is a struggle to repress forces that suck the blood, that exploit Black people, and who would deny us our democratic and even constitutional right to self-defense and self-determination.
And where has the proposal for community control of the police gone in terms of the Philadelphia government, the city council, the mayor?
Yes, yes. So we have drafted a law in the midst of the upcoming mayoral election. In fact, the primary elections are coming up on May 21st, which is the day of my pretrial conference. But they will be holding the preliminary, the primary elections to determine who's going to be on the general election ballot in November for mayor and city council and other public official seats. However, we understand that the real question isn't necessarily what individual occupies any given office, but more importantly, we are interested in controlling public policy and to control the institutions that carry out such policy. And in this case, we're talking about Black Community Control of Police. So we have drafted an amendment to the city's local constitution, which is known as the Home Rule Charter. And our amendment calls for things that I raised earlier in terms of the demand for the Black community to have its own independent, democratically elected Black Community Control of Police commissions that have the actual power to hire, fire, train, and prosecute police and armed forces that function within what we refer to as Black community districts. By Black community districts, we are talking about those geographic areas in the city in which that are defined as police districts by the government, those districts where the population is at least 50% Black, whether Spanish or English speaking. And in such districts, again, democratically elected and independent Black Community Control of Police with our power to prosecute, hire, fire, and train would function over all activities concerning armed forces within our community and to a very large extent determine policy as it relates to how these types of economic relationships that affected Willie Wise's ability to get paid are carried out. Things that the police and the DA's office would normally be over would be governed by the Black Community Controller Police Commission. So there's a state statute in the Pennsylvania Constitution that affords the right of citizens to not only introduce, but to have such amendments to local constitutions be placed on the general election should we gain 20,000 signatures on a petition. And so our objective is to win that amount of signatures for our Black Community Control of Police Charter Amendment. At the same time, it's important to note, and there actually has been a lot of controversy around the question of a certain kind of dictatorial character that city council in the city of Philadelphia has assumed. It's come to a head in the case of real estate and land and development, where this phenomenon known as councilmanic prerogative has been exposed by some of our comrades of an organization known as the Black and Brown Workers Collective, which has exposed the fact that city-owned properties are being sold by city council representatives within any given district to essentially the highest bidder. And by the highest bidder, we mean those private entities who are willing to do those under-the-table deals with the city council representative in question in exchange for not only good prices on such land, but first dibs on the land as well. And at the same time, city council manipulates the local constitution to override the state constitution, which requires that 20,000 signatures be recognized as the criteria for a charter amendment to get a place on the general election ballot. However, local city council forces, their position is that they have the final say, regardless of whether or not the 20,000 signatures is achieved. They would have the final say as to whether or not the proposed amendment in question gets on the ballot or not. And it's important to note that whether or not the outcome of our petition drive and petition to city council is successful by their standards, the fact of the matter is that to achieve 20,000 signatures is to achieve a general consensus in the community that we have a right to self-determination and to control our own Black Community Control of Police Commission. And whether or not city council unites with our charter amendment and the ability for it to be on the general election, we are building the Black Community Controller Police Commission even as we speak. And we understand that in the final analysis, the will of the people will be carried out through the struggle of the people. And so this entire process just serves to educate the masses of our people around the question of what must be done. And at the end of the day, genuine political power, which is what we are talking about when we talk about the demands of Black Community Controller Police, genuine political power comes from the barrel of the gun. And it is through the gun that the U.S. government and Philadelphia government imposes its will. And the capitalists, they impose their will on Black people. Spot Philly Wireless imposed its will on Willie and Black people every day through the gun. And they backed up by a much larger state apparatus in the form of the Philadelphia Police Department and the district attorney. But at the end of the day, they will only concede to a greater force, which is the masses of the people, once they have internalized the principles of this campaign of self-determination and to fight for our right to be in control of our own lives and secure our own community.
That was Diop Olukbala of the Black is Back Coalition, speaking from Philadelphia.
Last year, the murder of Black Brazilian politician Marielle Franco focused world attention on the deep racism that permeates Brazilian society. Then, later that year, Jair Bolsonaro, an openly racist right-winger, won election as president. Stephanie Riest is a freelance writer and researcher based in Rio de Janeiro. Riest wrote an article for Jacobin magazine titled Finding Mario Franco's Killers.
Currently in the Marielle Franco case, there have still only been two people arrested. One is Honey Lessa, who's alleged to have fired at the car containing Marielle and her driver, Anderson Gomez, as well as one of her aides. Marielle and Anderson were murdered in that assassination attempt while the aide survived, and as well as the driver, whose name is Elcio Vieira de Queiroz. And as of right now, it's kind of been stuck in this situation. Initially, when Lessa was arrested, he claimed that he acted alone. Very few people believe that because of the sophistication of the assassination attempt. They had cloned cars. They had turned off security cameras in the area in Rio where Marielle was assassinated. So everyone kind of believes that this was carried out by members of militias. Militias in Rio operate very similar to kind of your classic mafias through extortion, except in the case of Rio, many of them are current and former police officers, military officers, firefighters, who are all part of the larger military organization, because the police in Brazil are military police. There is a civil police, but they are in charge of investigations. And speaking of that, the civil police being investigated by the federal police for mishandling the case, precisely because these militias have a lot of ties to prominent politicians, particularly in the case of Rio de Janeiro. It's kind of the stronghold of militias in the country and have long since had a lot of ties to politicians through electoral racketeering, through various forms of irregular land sales. And so that's kind of where the case is right now. The civil police are being investigated by the federal police, but there hasn't really been any forward movement in answering the question of who called for this political assassination, given this web of political interests that tie many, many political parties to these paramilitary militia groups in Rio who are responsible for her assassination.
Yes, and reading your piece in Jacobin, Finding Marielle Franco's Killers, one is struck by the overlap between corruption and police and repression and outside of the law forces.
Yes, I think one of the issues that I'm increasingly trying to think through here in Brazil is how corruption is understood. I think very recently, especially with the revanchist backlash against the Workers' Party, corruption has ultimately meant one of two things, kind of this large-scale slush funds and money laundering between politicians and mostly construction companies, But there's also a sense, and I think this is where a lot of the backlash against the PC, the Workers' Party, and also PSOL, Marielle Franco's Socialist Party, comes from, this idea that corruption is giving things to poor people so that they vote for you at the end of the day. Any sort of social projects are ultimately construed as a form of corruption, whereas this type of organized crime between politicians and militias is kind of brushed aside as not necessarily a form of corruption, even though it's incredibly violent, it's incredibly extortionary, and also has many of the features of kind of classic corruption, money laundering, the illegal land sales. It's an interesting Brazilian turn of phrase. They call it grilagem, which literally means cricketing, because they say they take old documents and you put them, you know, in a drawer until crickets ruin them. And that's how you prove that you've owned the title to this land, even though you just fabricated the documents. But that's how a lot of these militia types organizations control vast swaths of territory in Rio. Some, by some calculations, it's around 2 million people live in militia controlled areas. And that also has vast electoral consequences. A lot of people talk about not being able to vote for the candidate that they want, or being forced into different types of extortion in other senses as well, like being forced to pay for security if you're a small business owner. Your only access to things like gas and running water being paying these criminal organizations. And so that's kind of, this question of corruption has gotten very muddled and politicized in Brazil, but I think there's a real sense where Bolsonaro, Jair Bolsonaro, and the president see the military and police forces as ultimately uncorruptible, because they are the ones who will save democracy, right? They're the last resort against communism, or now they're rallying against cultural Marxism. So these forces, because they're ultimately fighting for the good of the state, aren't seen as corrupt, even though they very much are, and are engaged in many of the same practices, even as drug trafficking organizations, stealing arms, drug trafficking themselves. So it's a very difficult topic to talk about, because people have very differing ideas of even what corruption means.
Does it go without saying that there is no left equivalent of the militias?
I think that the left in Brazil in particular, but even globally, has had a lot of trouble responding to the question of public security. Obviously, if we invest more in social programs, education, obviously that will help with questions of criminality, because there is a sense where those things are tied to poverty and people being exploited. But it is an immediate concern to people. So these long-term solutions often frustrate people. And so even the left-wing party in Brazil, when PT was in party, Dilma sent the army to Rio ahead of the World Cup and the Olympics to, quote-unquote, pacify certain favelas. Well, there was a whole pacification program, but to occupy, rather, certain favelas ahead of the Olympics, because they were seen as a threat to the tourists. So I think the left is being systematically attacked by these militias. Marielle Franco is probably the most emblematic case, because unfortunately she lost her life very tragically, but her political mentor, Marcelo Freixo, he has faced death threats almost his entire political career, because he is one of the few politicians who have investigated these militias here in Rio. So I have not heard of any left-wing militias, but I think the left's response to the question of public security has left a lot of people frustrated, in that people on the left see the supposedly left-wing parties like the PT using the same repressive tactics, sending in the army to Rio, where people on the right think that they're just not even serious about what are genuine concerns of people.
What was the effect of Marielle Franco's assassination on the morale and behavior of the left in Rio?
There was tremendous mobilization after her death. There were mass mobilizations. And now in this election year, it has become kind of a rallying cry for a lot of particularly Black LGBTQ and favela-born women to run for office. And a number of them were elected in this past federal election to positions ranging from state deputies and federal deputies and senators. So there has been a certain political mobilization, but I do think that there has also been a very real sense of fear. John Willis, who is also a member of the PSOL party, he has left Brazil. He was a federal deputy. He was reelected, but decided to go into self-exile in Europe because of the death threats that he was receiving. So there is a sense that increasingly left-wing politicians are being attacked. And this also goes to what one of my friends, a fellow PhD candidate, Matthew Richmond, has referred to on Twitter as kind of the Colombianization of violence against left-wing activists in Brazil. So it's a lot more targeting of activists, especially in more rural areas or the Amazon. Right-wing and large landowners are killing indigenous activists, activists of the landless workers movement. So a lot of that demobilization is also happening at the base because of this threat of violence.
Violence, political and otherwise, is endemic in Brazil. I read 50,000 murders a year. And I've also heard, and from people that I trust, that lots of folks, Black folks in favelas, voted for Bolsonaro because of crime and lawlessness and security.
Yeah, I think this is the classic kind of issue I think with Black communities throughout the diasporas, this feeling of being simultaneously over and under policed. The phrase Black on Black crime actually comes from, I believe, activists in Chicago calling for police to investigate crimes in Black neighborhoods. It's obviously been distorted, but when Black people are the victims, the police do not mobilize to investigate those crimes. But they are policed in senses of their communities being terrorized and repressed. And I mean, here in Rio with the military occupation, there's even questions of curfews and things like that. So how to get beyond this sense of feeling simultaneously over and under policed is a real question. And I think Bolsonaro had a very straightforward policy platform of wanting to fight crime, but how he envisions it is not about, you know, investigations or even making the police safe. I think this is a question that gets back to Marielle Franco's own work. She repeatedly wrote about ensuring the lives of police officers as well, because unlike the United States, the vast majority of the rank and file of police officers are also Black and brown. So while the police in itself is often construed as this racist institution, which is true, part of that racism is also against the rank and file members, because when they commit atrocities, you can always blame the bad apples. And because those bad apples are invariably Black and brown, you don't have to reform the system. And this, to me, this goes back to slavery. And because Brazil had such a large enslaved population, a lot of the overseers and even people in charge of capturing runaway slaves, they themselves are Black. The Black and brown people have often been used to maintain systems of oppression in police through policing as a scapegoat and a buffer to higher ranking elites. So Bolsonaro's platform had a certain appeal to people in that it was just so straightforward, you know, let the police just do their job. And also the question of liberating the possession of arms, he has brought that up and allowing people to defend themselves, like the rhetoric goes in the U.S., but all the science points to that only creating more violence.
That was writer and researcher Stephanie Reist.
Jaime Alves is a member of the Brazilian Black Movement and assistant professor of anthropology at the College of Staten Island in New York City. Alves maintains that the racist president Bolsonaro won last year's election because of deep fears of Black people. Brazil, says Professor Alves, is a killing field for Black youth.
We're talking about 60,000 people being killed every year in Brazil, and 80% to 75 to 80% of them are black people, and mostly black young men. And when we speak of just about the police violence, the police kills at least 14 young black men in Brazil every single day. Which country in the world has this rate of black homicide, of genocide?
I once heard a stat that in Brazil, one out of every 12 encounters with police results in death.
That is true. That is true. So in the case of São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, for example, think about this. Only the case of São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, the police is responsible for at least 25% of the homicides. And we are talking about official rates. Not the ones that have disappeared, that in Brazil we have an astonishing rate of people that are disappeared, and most of them are black. So think of that. There are 25% of the homicides that we can hold the police accountable for.
And yet in Brazil, the reigning ideology is that it is a race-free society.
Totally. So that's very hard to fight black genocide in Brazil. Even the word genocide, many circles take this as like an overstatement. But indeed, it's becoming very hard to fight black genocide in Brazil because there is no race in Brazil, as the main discourse goes, it says, right? There is no race in Brazil. There is no problem in Brazil for racial problem in Brazil because we are racial democracy. So how do you face black genocide in a state, in a society that denies the very existence of race? And yet, race is part of the everyday life.
Yes, and in Sao Paulo, the largest city in Brazil, and you were just mentioning that city, there was a huge massacre by police of young black men not too many years ago.
Yes, in 2006, there was a famous May massacre, yet another anniversary of impunity. At least 600 people, most of them, again, young black men, were killed by the police in the span of 1 week. And all these killings go unpunished. There is no one holds account for these kids. But we can even talk about other. The Mothers of May, that is a most prominent movement against the police terror in Brazil, they say that Brazil is the country of open graves, the graveyard. Brazil is a graveyard because we can talk about massacres of May of 2006, many, many massacres that we cannot even count anymore. It's become normalized, a country of normalized massacres.
And yet Bolsonaro says that the police don't kill enough.
Bolsonaro says that police don't kill enough. But Bolsonaro is just a metaphor of the Brazilian nation. Bolsonaro is racist, homophobic, sexist, patriarchal. This man has everything that we have fought against for all our lives. And yet Bolsonaro is just a symptom of a society that is anti-black to its core. So how do we come to terms to the fact that even during the Workers' Party administration, black genocide in Brazil was part of the structure of the state, of the nation? The Workers' Party can be defined as an administration that granted rights and denied life. During the Workers' Party administration, the police killed as much as the police is killing now. So it shows, it uncovers the nature of the Brazilian state, a racial genocidal state that Bolsonaro is bringing to the next level. But we cannot understand Bolsonaro without understanding the history of anti-blackness in the Brazilian society.
Yes, similar to the United States, most of the big cities of this country, where most black people live, are run by Democratic Party mayors. That's supposed to be the party in which most black people participate, but the killing goes on nonetheless.
Exactly, because the state is meant to protect white life, white and no black life. So if the state is that, if we are talking about a regime of rights that is racialized to its core, so there is no way that we can think about protecting black lives from within the state, because the reason of the state, of survival, of existence of the state requires this anti-black violence. Think, for example, in Brazil, the deployment of the army to police cities in Brazil. So how do we understand this? The army is supposed to protect the borders, to protect the nation against its external enemies. But because blacks are treated as enemies of the state, enemies of civil society, so it is justified that the state deploys the army to police the favelas in São Paulo, in Rio, in Salvador, in major Brazilian cities.
So here we have a state that sees itself as defending the nation against people who are, as African descendants, a majority of that nation.
Yes, blacks in Brazil now is 51-52% of the population. So the majority that is disenfranchised from the nation, disenfranchised for the rights of citizenship, excluded from the political life, or when they stand out with the political life, or when they do work like Marielle Franco, so they are met with terror. So police terror is a regime of contention of black lives. Blacks are supposed to be in the favela. Blacks are supposed to stay in their place, not participate in the Brazilian polity, because the Brazilian polity is not supposed to mean for the black people.
Now, in more recent years, we saw the institution of affirmative action in Brazil, and an amazing thing seemed to happen. It appeared that the black population grew almost exponentially because people were declaring themselves to be black who had not called themselves black before.
Yeah, Brazil, we saw in the last, during the Workers' Party administration, an amazing, that's the contradiction of the Workers' Party administration, because during the administration, we saw a revival, a exciting presence of the blacks in these spaces of that blacks were historically absent. So the public universities that are majority white universities have become more diverse. Shopping malls that were places for just for whites has become more diverse. But then you see white reactions to this. So in some extent, to go back to Bolsonaro things, so in some extent the reaction of Bolsonaro, the election of Bolsonaro is also a reaction to this timid increasing of black participation in this space of privilege. That was not a raw racial progress in Brazil, but we had like some opening for black participation in the sphere of consumption, in public access to public education. So in these spaces, historically white, black participation has been met with racial terror. So Bolsonaro's election also can be understood as a reaction to this very initial stage of democratization of Brazilian society.
So if Bolsonaro is, in U.S. terms, a product of white backlash, then why is it that we hear of him getting substantial votes in mostly black favelas?
This is very important, but this is very important question. And you know, the sad things about societies that are organized around race or around anti-blackness is that black people are not free from this contradiction. Anti-blackness is pervasive, is diffused, is socially shared. So anti-blackness as an organizing principle of our society, of the United States, of a Brazilian society, is not exclusive to whites. All social groups share with this anti-blackness in the belief that they can have some access to some rights if they show the anti-blackness. So we can understand that blacks that voted for Bolsonaro in two ways. First of all, they may just realize that their lives were not so different under the Workers' Party. When it comes to protecting life, the right to live, their lives were not that different from what they lived before Bolsonaro. And secondly, as a socialist shared value, as a socialist shared ideology, anti-blackness is pervasive to all aspects of Brazilian society.
Yes, socialists here, or people who call themselves socialists in the United States, often don't want to talk about race, just like in Brazil. You're not supposed to talk about race.
And that's what we credit the left for the Bolsonaro disaster. The left was unable to organize around black suffering. If black suffering is part of the ethos of Brazilian society, a radical project for the left would be a project that embraced blackness as a political principle, embraced the black identity as a mobilizing identity, embraced black agenda as the agenda that could galvanize larger population around the refoundation of the Brazilian society. So the left have been unable, unwilling to embrace blackness, embrace black suffering, embrace black demands as a departure point to organize larger civil society, larger public around a real revolutionary project.
So the left fails to embrace the blackness of the country, and yet we get the white backlash anyway.
Exactly. The blacklash is there because if the Brazilian society is poor and by white, organized by white, for white, so Bolsonaro project is make Brazil great again. Make Brazil great again, as we know in the other side of the Americas, is to make Brazil white again, or at least no black. There is where we can see a common ground between the left and the right. The original project of the Brazilian society, the Brazilian nation, was not supposed to be inclusive of the black subject. The black subject is a placeless subject within the Brazilian nation.
Is there anything in Brazil that resembles the Black Power movement that existed and still to some degree exists in the United States?
We have a very vibrant black social movement. We have underground black social movement that may not be characterized, may not be understood in the same paradigm of black organized that we see in the Black Panther movement or the civil rights movement in the United States. But we have several examples. That is what I tried to uncover in my book, is how can we think about black resistance in a country that denies blackness as a valuable category for organizing. So to answer this question, we may look at different ways of organizing, underground organizing, in the world of crime, for example. Can you think about gang violence, retaliatory violence against the state terror by black gang men engaged in criminality, as controversial as it is? Can we understand this as a form of, as a disparate form of resistance against the state terror? So we have a very, very vibrant and very large, comprehensive agenda of black resistance that comprises formal politics, embracing civil society politics, but also outlaws kinds of resistance that we must to consider in society like Brazil, where to understand race, you have to understand everyday life, how race is lived and resisted in everyday life, not necessarily under the terms of progressive leftist politics.
With the advent of Bolsonaro, has the left, the Workers' Party, and the left-wing party that Ms. Franco belonged to, have they learned any lessons in terms of race?
I suspect the left will not learn. We are talking about a left that is mostly white, middle class. Black people that participate in the left to have their demands heard. They have to leave the blackness at home and go to the streets as workers, as poor, as students, anything but black. So that creates a lot of constraint, a lot of challenges for organizing as leftist civil society. At the same time, we, black people, are blamed for fragmentizing the struggle. So actually, many in the left blame the black people for Bolsonaro's victory. You see how identity politics became divisionary. And at the same time, we say, well, black people are the ones that have founded most of the radical leftist movement. Unions are racialized. Domestic workers that organize, they are racialized. But our agenda, our identity is not taken into consideration when the left, large leftist politics are on the table. So I don't think the left have learned the lesson. I don't think so. Because even now, reactions to Bolsonaro are reactions still that still subscribe a very colorblind politics in face of the largest black nation on earth after Nigeria.
Well, why don't black leftists just organize on their own as black folks with race uppermost in mind as well as class?
Well, the black movement have historically tried. They have been cannibalized, domesticated the radical blacks that get into the leftist politics. And what I think that the black movement should do and must consider, to be honest, many are considering, is that, well, it may be time to give up from electoral politics. Electoral politics has shown its limits, not only in Brazil, but in the whole continent. This white blackness, this reconfiguration of right-wing politics throughout the continent shows the limits of electoral politics. So maybe Bolsonaro's election brings to us a very exciting new moment. It's a moment of disillusion, dystopic moment, but also a liberatory moment. It's time to grow up and know that electoral politics or democracy, electoral democracy, is not enough, and we will not accommodate black demand. Not only black demand, but is black life possible within a democratic state of rights? That to be democratic and to be a state of rights requires black death.
But abandoning electoral politics in Brazil does not mean giving up the view of seizing power in Brazil, does it?
It doesn't. But then we have to put on the table what are the possibilities for us? How do we defend our lives? So this is a very complicated debate, because what I'm suggesting here is we have to consider, at least as a political, ethical question, is what is the place of violence, legitimate violence, to decolonize Brazilian society? So in this conversation can be taken anywhere that is very dangerous in times of terrorism, in times in which any conversation about this is categorized as terrorism. The terrorists are the ones that fight against state terrorism. But this is an ethical question. How do we ethically deploy violence in name of free our society, in name of protecting our lives? So this is a very complicated, honest, and timely conversation in times of Bolsonaro. How do we protect our lives? How do we deploy legitimate violence to decolonize a society that's organized around anti-black terror? Do we go to the streets with protests, sit-ins protests? Do we demand conversations with the government? Do we write open letters asking Bolsonaro to respect human rights? Do we write manifestos like civil society do and denounce violations of human rights? How do we respond to that? Because all of this has been ineffective. We are tired and sick of manifestos. We are tired and sick of meetings behind doors with government officials. All of this has been unable to stop the machine of the black genocide in Brazil.
That kills every day.
Astonishing levels, unbelievable levels, outrageous, unstoppable. I would like just to highlight that despite of our dystopian moment, we have a very vibrant black social movement. And I would highlight here the place of black women taking the leadership of these anti-black social movements in Brazil. So at the same time that we have a leftist movement that is very colorblind, we have in the other extreme, black women take the leadership to decolonize the Brazilian left as well. And we cannot talk today, nowadays, about Brazil, about resistance in Brazil, without praising, recognize, publicly acknowledge the work of Mães de Maio, Mothers of May, or Mothers of May is the Brazilian mothers of a child killed by the police. They are the ones that embrace this radical politics, and as they say, we want to demilitarize Brazil and demilitarize the Americas. So I think it's from their experience that we can learn how to embrace radical politics.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you.